Sandra Gionis.
And I'm Irene Critacopoulos.
And welcome to Core 670, the podcast. We're both members of the Hellenic Heritage Foundation's History Committee. The HHF is a nonprofit organization dedicated to raising funds to support or endow Hellenic education, culture, and heritage projects across Canada. Our award-winning history committee, Thank You Heritage Toronto, is made up of professional and amateur historians dedicated to working on public history projects. Really, we're just history nerds.
And archaeology nerds, too. I studied classical civilization and Near and Middle Eastern civilization at the University of Toronto, and I have a Master's of Science in the Technology and Analysis of Archaeological Materials from University College London.
I am totally impressed. We're back at it again this year after our podcast series from last year, The Idea of Greece, which looked at the Greek Revolution 200 years later. This year, the HHF is sponsoring the visit of someone very special to our hometown, Toronto. Irene, tell us about the Royal Ontario Museum's Core 670 exhibit.
Core 670 will be here from March 12th to September 25th, 2022. It's part of an exchange with the Acropolis Museum in Athens. And the star is Core 670, a statue you'll learn all about in this episode.
And this podcast will have two episodes. Today, we look at the Core herself. And next time, we look at the story behind how she got here and some more issues around antiquities and the museum world. And we welcome our first guest. Paul Denis is Assistant Curator, Art and Culture of Ancient Greece and Rome at the Royal Ontario Museum, or as we in this city refer to it as ROM. It's the temporary home of the Core 670 exhibit for the next 6 months. So, Paul, you get to live with her. Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much. It is a great pleasure for me to be here to talk to you about a great treasure from Greece.
Well, can you explain to us before we start and to help describe her, we'll get into that. But can you tell us what is a core for people who've never heard this term before?
Core is a Greek word for girl or maiden. And so the statue of a core is a marble statue of a young girl, a maiden, very opulently dressed, wearing jewelry, richly decorated hair. The hair is very rich. And topped off with jewelry and wearing a crown or a stephani. They were gifts to the goddess Athena made by wealthy Greek citizens at the time. And this core dates from about 520 to 510 BC from the Greek archaic period. And originally, the core would have been painted, but we can get into that later.
So how was she numbered 670?
670 is the accession number of the piece. The accession number that the old Acropolis Museum, they gave her. We have accession numbers on all of our objects as well. And so, you know, there's Core 528. There's different numbers for different Core that were found. Each one has their own particular number.
More people are familiar with the classical period in Greece, especially in Athens. How is the archaic different from the classical period?
The archaic period itself is usually dated to about 650 BC to 480 BC. So this was generally the archaic period in ancient Greece, in Athens. And Athens would have been, during this period, towards 480, would have been a bustling metropolis. The Acropolis itself would have looked different, much different than the Acropolis today. The archaic Acropolis would have likely had an archaic temple dedicated to Athena. And around the time, right before the Persian invasion of Greece, the Greeks were building another temple on the Acropolis to celebrate the victory of the Marathon in 490, a bigger temple to Athena. But that they only built the base and some of the columns before the Persians attacked Athens. At that time, Athens itself, the government, would have been run by these oligarchies, these tyrants. And then sort of the date is 508 BC. When the tyrants were expelled from Athens, and 508, sort of the beginnings of democracy started in Athens. And during this period, I mean, there was great artistic achievement, not only in sculpture, which the Acropolis would have been populated with many Core, other sculptural dedications. Sculpture was flourishing at that time, but also in black figure vase painting and the beginnings of red figure vase painting. And so Athens at that time would have been a real flourishing cultural center during the late Archaic period. And it's from this flourishing period that the Chore originates from. The classical period, the sculptures tend to be more ideal, more human-like or ideal, whereas the Archaic period, they tend to be a little stiff.
And what is it about our Chore that makes it obvious she's an Archaic statue rather than one from the classical period?
What makes this statue archaic is, first of all, the very frontal pose. I mean, the statue's almost, I wouldn't say frozen, but it's very frontal. She's looking forward. And then these Chore, they're all sort of very typical. She has one leg advanced and her right arm is held up and she's holding a sacrifice or an offering to the goddess Athena. It could be an apple, it could be a dove. And then her left arm is usually holding some of her drapery, which we'll see in our Chore. The modeling in the Archaic period was very finicky and very detailed. You'll see this on the sculpture, very well detailed. The hair is very well done. And then what makes the Chore archaic so much, or archaic sculpture, she has this wonderful so-called archaic smile on her face, as most archaic sculpture does. Because this was a time when the Greek sculptors were sort of grappling on rendering the human form. And so they were still working on how to show the face naturally. It's just a matter of these different stylizations. And that's why these Chore have these wonderful sort of sweet smiles.
I was going to ask you, does she have a Mona Lisa smile? Because it's got that kind of ambiguous quality, doesn't it?
Yes, all of the Chore do. And they all have got this ambiguous smile. Because the sculptors were grappling with rendering the human form as naturally as they didn't really succeed until the classical period, you know, which starts at 480.
Paul, you mentioned earlier they were often paid for by rich Athenians to pray to the goddess Athena. Was it just for each of these private families to pray to the goddess, or were they there for other Athenians to come up and to pray to Athena as well?
Well, other Athenians obviously could pray to Athena, but these statues were dedications by a family. And unfortunately, we don't have all of their usually inscriptions that accompany these statues. And the inscription usually names the donor, the family, and sometimes even the sculptor. Apparently, the Acropolis Museum, they found 200 fragments and Chore from different Chore. So, the Acropolis would have been a very busy place, the Archaic Acropolis, with all of these Chore standing on pedestals.
Wow.
And various other dedications as well.
It sounds just beautiful to imagine.
Yes, yeah.
And Paul, how does our Chore, Chore 670, compare with other Chore, which have been uncovered from even different sites and locations in Greece and the Aegean and Anatolia?
From our Chore, she's late Archaic, 520-510 BC, or ripe Archaic. And she differs in the sense that, there are earlier Chore that were found like in Samos or in some of the islands, but they tend to be very statuesque, whereas this Chore is leaning towards naturalism. And what makes our Chore different than, for example, the other Chore that were found on the Acropolis is that she's only wearing a chiton, which is like a tunic, a dress, whereas most of the other Chore that were found are wearing a chiton and a hymation. A hymation is like a shawl that's worn diagonally across the front of the Chore. And adds another level, whereas ours is just draped in a chiton. There are only two that were found like that on the Acropolis.
That's really interesting. And where exactly on the Acropolis was our Chore found?
As I mentioned before, in 480 BC, the Persians attacked Athens. And so the Athenian citizens evacuated Athens. They went to Salamis and various other places. And then the Persians sacked the city, and then they left the Acropolis in ruins. And then a year later, in 479, after the Greeks defeated the Persians and came back to their city, you know, the city in ruins or and the Acropolis in ruins, they eventually started to clear the, you know, the damaged, it wasn't just sculpture, everything was damaged on the Acropolis, the old temple to Athena, the one they were just starting to build. And so there was all this rubble, damage on top of the Acropolis. And eventually they left it there for a while to sort of a reminder of what the Persians did to them. And then eventually they started clearing the Acropolis. And then 14 Korae, 14 of them were buried together just northwest of the present day Erechtheum. They were buried in a pit, and sometimes this with other debris, and sometimes this pit is called the Korae pit. And then the Korae were buried, and then they were left undisturbed, you know, for many, many centuries. And because they were buried, they were protected from the elements like sun, wind, and rain, which corrodes marble and paint, because these Korae were highly painted when the Greeks liberated Greece from the Ottoman rule and the Acropolis was liberated. The Greek archaeologists in 1833 started eventually clearing the Acropolis of all of the Turkish material and all the other debris up there. And then in 1886, when they made the, or it was 1850, they started digging down to the bedrock of the Acropolis. And then in 1886, in early 1886, January, February, they discovered the Korae pit, and they discovered 14 Korae. And because they had been so well protected in the ground, they found the same 14 Korae that the Greeks buried in 479 or four, you know, in the 400 BC. They were so well preserved, a lot of their original pigment was left. And so it's through this miraculous find that it's one of the other instances which proved that Greek sculpture was painted, which is kind of jarring to today's aesthetic of thinking of pure, beautiful white sculpture, but it wasn't. It was highly painted.
I wanted to follow up about that, Paul, you know, in terms of how she would have originally looked in terms of her pigment, her color. Were they a kind of muted color or were they bright colors? Can you tell us what kind of colors the archaic Greeks seemed to favor?
Oh, the colors would have been very, very bright. Bright blues, yellows, reds, browns, and the skin would have been highly polished. Some people think it was painted white. So other scholars believe it was sort of highly polished wax to give it an ivory color. And this would have been, and the colors, the paints were made from minerals, like azurite was crushed to make blue, for example. And so these sculptures would have been brightly painted because you'd have to imagine a Korae standing on a pedestal in the bright blue sort of Greek sky, Mediterranean sky, standing on the Acropolis. If they were white, you wouldn't be able to sort of define them. But if they were highly painted, you know, they would be very, very obvious, very legible in the Greek sunlight, beautiful blue skies you associate with Greece. And same with the sculptures and pediments of temples. I mean, these sculptures too were very highly painted against blue backgrounds of the pediment. And so they would have been very legible to people looking at them from the upwards from the ground as well.
That paints such a different picture from what we think of when we look at what the Acropolis looks like today in its, you know, ancient white ruins.
Yeah.
Did the colors that they adorned the Korae with, were they similar to the type of colors the Athenians themselves would have been wearing at the time in terms of their clothing, in terms of even, you know, the similar jewelry that Athenian women would have been wearing back then?
Oh, absolutely, yes. The especially the textiles that women wore would have been very brightly adorned as well, and especially the jewelry. The Korae were getting was wearing a snake bracelet and a necklace and these disc-shaped earrings as well. And a lot of the painting is preserved. That's what I hope people see. We purposely set the Korae up sort of at eye level so people can walk around the Korae too, because the back is just as beautiful as the front, to admire the details and look at the painted details as well. In the earring, on her hair, her stephan, her crown, and then her chiton as well.
I would definitely wear some of her jewelry. It really is beautiful. And I have to ask you, did the women of the day have those kinds of hairstyles? Because it's nuts. It's just so tightly curled.
Yeah, yeah. I guess so. Maybe these sculptures were made for in a very special way for the hair to look like that.
Maybe it was their special dues on for big occasions. Who knows?
Exactly. Exactly.
It sounds like the Acropolis of the Archaic period was a much more colorful place than what we associate the Acropolis with today. Would other structures have been painted on the Acropolis as well, or just the Corée shining brightly colored in the sunlight?
There were other dedications on the Acropolis, and so they would have been highly painted as well. And some of the sculpture that was found during the excavations of the Acropolis in the late 19th century, they found some pedimental sculpture from the Archaic period and statues of Athena, Hercules battling a Triton, and even the so-called Bluebeard. And all of these sculptures were highly painted too. Yeah, everything would have been painted. That's what's so deceptive today. We think of even Roman sculpture would have been highly painted too. And that's a deception. Like when you walk into the Greek gallery, there's all this gleaming white sculpture, but it wouldn't have been like that in antiquity. It would have been highly painted. In Greece, a sculptor did not think his sculpture was finished until it was painted.
That's really interesting compared to what we have today in our perceptions of sculpture.
Oh, yeah.
How often would the average everyday Athenian have gone up to the Acropolis? You know, how much foot traffic would have been up there?
That is an excellent question. I guess it would all depend on if there was some sort of festival for Athena, then the population would go to the old temple of Athena. There were Pan-Athenaic festivals, festivals to Athena in Athens. And so the population might go up to the Acropolis. But this is just speculation on my part. I don't think the Acropolis would be a place to sort of hang out. You'd do that in the Agora, you know, where you could buy food and wine. And that would be the place to hang out. But I think the Acropolis would have been more for worship of the goddess and to make your dedications to Athena.
Kind of like church on Sundays.
Yeah, exactly.
The Acropolis that was rebuilt, is that as close as possible to the structure we're used to seeing today?
The rebuilt Acropolis, yes. That started mainly during the time of Pericles, his embellishment of the Acropolis. You know, the Parthenon we see, the Erechtheum, the Propylaea, the gateway. What we see today was built during the second half of the 5th century BC on the Acropolis.
I asked about the Acropolis as it's recognized today because it's part of a bigger controversy in the world of antiquities. The museum you've partnered with on this exchange, Paul, the Acropolis Museum, is a major actor in the story. What's infamously missing from the Acropolis are the many friezes and marble statues which adorned it up until very early in the 19th century. They were removed by one Lord Elgin and taken to his native Great Britain, where they remain today on view at the British Museum. And that story about antiquities and ownership and repatriation demands we're saving for our next podcast.
Plus, we'll look at how this exchange happened in the first place and the bigger questions of what museums should be.
Thanks, Paul, for joining us today. It was a pleasure meeting you, and you've really enlightened us about this quarry.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much. And thanks to the Hellenic Heritage Foundation for their generous funding to make this exhibition a reality.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours. We would like to end with a recording of Powys' Ancient Music Ensemble from the Siculo Ancient World Music channel on YouTube. Irene, tell us about this music.
This is the closest music we could find to the archaic era when the quarry was sculpted. You'll hear the ethereal vocals of Rui Fu, Nikos Varelas, on an instrument called the ancient bendir, which is a percussion instrument, and Theodoros Koumardis on an ancient Greek lyre.
Here's to the archaic era. A special thank you to the Royal Ontario Museum and the Acropolis Museum and the Greek State, which arranged for the Kore 670 exhibit. We at the HHF are proud to sponsor her visit. I'm Sandra Gionis.
And I'm Irene Critacopoulos. This podcast was produced by the Hellenic Heritage Foundation's History Committee. Our researchers are Helen Walsh, Tina Poulimenou Tsatsanis, Stavroula Michalopoulos, and Barbara Athanasoulas. Our story editor is Tina Poulimenou Tsatsanis. Our technical editor is Stan Papoukas. Thank you to our sponsor, Agape Greek Radio. Our executive producer is Sandra Gionis.
You can find this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and at our website, hhf.ca, as well as the website of the Quarry 670 exhibit. Go to rom.on.ca for more information. Join us for our next episode when we draw the curtains on how exhibits like this come to be and the museum world at large. Thanks for joining us.